Accession number 21554, real.
This is the first reel of a taped interview with Jim Moyer in Perth, Western Australia, on the 1st of the 6th, 2001, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Jim, could we start the interview by you telling us your full name and where and when you were born, please?
Yeah, my surname is Moyer, M-O-I-R. My Christian name's James Fiddes, F-I-E-E-S. I was born in Fremantle on the 6th of July 1919.
Can you tell us a little bit about your family background and growing up in Fremantle?
Yeah. With my family background, my parents came out from Scotland in, I think it was 1911. We always lived in the Fremantle area. I went to school at East Fremantle School, primary. And then went to Fremantle Boys School, which was a secondary school then, and attained my junior certificate, which in those days was usually the finishing period for most school children. Those who could afford it, and others went on perhaps to a leaving certificate, but in those days junior certificate was the main.
How old off. Then was junior certificate?
Well, as a matter of fact, it was 14 mostly. In my case, I had turned 15. The reason for that being that as a young child, I was unfortunate enough to get lockjaw, tetanus as it's known, isn't it, lockjaw, and I missed a year of schooling as a result of it while I recuperated up in the hills in Kalamunda. So I was really a year older than most of the kids that I was at school with for that reason.
Can you tell us the names of your parents? And the rest of your family?
Yeah, well, my father's name is the same as myself, James Fiddes. My mother was a Jenny. I think her maiden name, Scottish, was Jenny MacDonald. I had an elder brother, Alexander, who was in the same unit as myself. In fact, we're in the same company. I can tell you more about that later on. I have an elder sister, Jean, and a younger brother, Donald.
Tell us about your family life. What was it like?
Well, up till the time that I left school, we lived opposite the Fremantle Golf Links, so a lot of time was spent on the golf links, caddying, and in those days, you know, kids were different lifestyle and different necessities for amusing yourself at what it was today. Spent a lot of time on the golf links, caddying, in spare time, you know, at the weekends. During school holidays, I was very fortunate in that I spent a lot of my school holidays in the orchards in Kalamunda on a vineyard in the Upper Swan, through Scottish friends of my parents had invited me up there, and that was the biggest part, really, of it.
What about your recollections of how the family sort of coped during the Depression?
Well, actually, they coped fairly well. So my father, at this time, became a waterside worker, and I don't know how it worked, I was too young to remember that, but apparently they got their equal share of whatever work was down there, so that we weren't affected, not that way, not until we left school. And actually, when we did leave school, my elder brother was the first one to leave school, and he got a job at Elder Smith's in Fremantle, and he was born in 1914, I think 1930. He went to work, and Elder Smith's closed down, and bang, that was the end of almost a pre-war work for him. He went away and worked where he could on farms and on an irrigation project down the southwest. But in my own case, I was at school until I left school, and then I obtained a job in Bunbury, as a matter of fact, because my mother had made sure that we had within her power. It was a good education. Both my elder sister and brother did a bit of a business course before they went to work. In my case, she got me to start studying accountancy through Hemi and Robertson's. And I think this was the main reason I got the job down Bunbury. Although I was only 15, I had started this. And then, of course, I went to Bunbury. And I obtained the job through an advert in the paper, was in Bunbury and applied for it. I think the fact that I was studying accountancy probably swayed him, even though I was only a bit of a kid at the time, to get the job down there.
Well, tell us a little bit about the job.
The job was with the Bunbury Municipal Council. I started off just as a junior clerk, but in a fairly short time I was made, well, I was only probably about 17, I was made the cashier down there, and I was in that job until I was 20 when I enlisted in the army. And that was a very interesting job, because in those days, with councils or shires, you just didn't collect rates. You did the car licences, all sorts of things, dog licences, whatever, whatever. It was all cemetery board. It was all run by the shire in those days. So it was quite an interesting job. And you met people all the time coming into the counter.
This would have been sometime around 1935, 36.
Yeah, I went there in 35, up till I enlisted in 1940.
What do you recall then of people talking about the situation in Europe and how it was deteriorating?
Well, to be quite honest, John, because unlike today we have television that's thrown up in front of you all the time and radios and wirelesses, I don't think that I boarded in Bunbury, and the house where I was, I don't think even had a radio. So unless you bought the paper and on the wages you were getting for a start, you couldn't afford to do that every day yourself. So you really weren't in the picture a lot in regard to it.
So you had you heard anything about Hitler at all?
Oh, yes, but to be quite honest, at my age now, I don't recall a lot of it until the war actually started, and then you're involved.
Had anyone ever sort of spoken to you about the First World War, for instance?
No, not particularly. No. I worked with chaps who had been in the service of the First World War. As a matter of fact, I could tell you a story about one of them with whom I worked. When his son, who was a personal friend of mine, enlisted at the same time as me, and this chap said, "Oh, Reg will be a great soldier because he's only small. He's as strong as a big man, and being small, he'll be able to take cover." He was the first man that got killed in Syria. He was the first casualty to be killed, so it didn't work out. But there are things I always remembered his father saying this to me about his son, what would happen. So there were some returned servicemen there. Mainly after the war had broken out, the Second World War, then they spoke to you about their experiences.
What
like
sort of things did they tell you that you can recall? What feeling did they give you about being a soldier?
No, I can't. Be quite honest, I can't really recall that, John. No.
How did you sort of see them? Do you think?
Oh, I looked up to them. They were great. They were returned servicemen, and I had felt this way myself. With it now that we are returned servicemen, for instance, just recently at one of the committee meetings for the battalion association I was in, the brother of one of our members who got killed, in fact he was with me when he died, and his brother came along to one of our meetings because he wanted some information, and I got him to become an associate member, and then he didn't turn up for a while, and when I met him one Anzac Day, I said, "You never came back." He said, "Well, I didn't feel embarrassed, but I felt that you chaps were on a different plane to what, although he was only probably a couple of years younger, his brother had been old enough." He said, "I felt that you chaps were on a different plane to me." He'd been too young to be in the services, but he thought that we were something from not out of space. And that's, I think, how we looked on First World War chaps. I mean, you never feel it yourself. To me, we're all just the same as, and you are just the same. It's just the fact that you have been through something that they were not through, that they just look at me. And I know that we have a lot of associate members now. In fact, our association is very strong, and we have encouraged younger people to come and join us. And they are things that we take for granted all the time because of your service. They are almost in awe about it. You don't think of it that way yourself. You really don't. You think, you know, you sort of wonder, you know, what's so big about it, because you've taken too much, perhaps too much for granted.
I'm interested to talk about that. Maybe we can talk about it later on, but there does seem to be a certain understanding that can only be shared with people that you have served with.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I think particularly in the earlier days after the war, you felt that way in regard to it, that it was something that wasn't to be shared. And I think that's why people haven't spoken about it. And in later life, I know most of us, perhaps all of us, had realised how wrong that was, because the younger people should know what happened, even if it's only the horrors of war, to prevent it happening again. That's an important thing in my book. There's no doubt that early in the piece you didn't share your experiences or your knowledge at all. You just, well, didn't want to talk about it, and it was wrong. I feel it was really wrong.
Do you think that it's a sort of situation where you didn't really feel as though you were able to fit in sort of society once you'd come back, and therefore you didn't want to be expressing?
No, but I still think that you took what had happened to you for granted, because when I came back, actually I was discharged at the end of 1943 because I'd been wounded and I was boarded below A class to go back to my own unit. In actual fact, I was sent to Rottnest for a couple of weeks, and after being an active unit like I was, it certainly didn't suit, and I got the opportunity that I could go into a essential industry, because I didn't want to be stuck on Rottnest Island. Quite happy, but a lot of folks probably quite happy to spend the war there. But when I went to work, and I worked out at Rob's Jetty Meatworks as a clerk, and I never felt, I didn't feel that my war experience or having been a serviceman made me any different than any other people I was working with. Never even discussed it with them, and no one ever discussed it with me. But the only thing that, one bad thing it did do, as a result of your years in the services, and having spent your life with men all the time, because particularly in our type unit, you were never in, we spent very little time in Australia, so you weren't able to have the company of the type of people you would know, mostly, say, in the Middle East or in New Guinea. I got itchy feet, and I've experienced this. In fact, I've spoken to other people about this. As a result of your type of lifestyle, you had itchy feet. I worked at Rob's Jetty, and after 1 year, I heard that Wyndham Meatworks had opened. I couldn't get away quick enough to be on the move again, and so I went up to Wyndham. And it was just, I think this is the unfortunate, unfortunate part of it. Your lifestyle, and especially for young people, so I went in when I was 20, and when you're 20 till you're 23, there's so much formation should be taking place in your life, but it's the right sort of formation as much as perhaps the experience you're getting and the comradeship, but it's wrong in as much as it upsets your lifestyle, the lifestyle you're going to live for the rest of your life.
So you're not really prepared to come back and live a...
Well, to be quite honest, John, I know it will come out later. I had a bit of a bad trot, as I mentioned, after I had been wounded. And when I came back, I know the chaps from Vietnam said that they didn't get counselling, but when I came back, I just came back and was out on the street, you know. I didn't get any counselling at all, and yet I had experiences in those 31 days where I hope I handle it better now to you, but I don't normally handle it too well because of what happened to my comrades at the time. It was almost unbelievable the way they died. And that, and even now, I go to water sometimes, and I did particularly then. I'd go to water badly because what I saw happened to those chaps.
Mm. Well, we can talk about all of that later on if you like.
But I do think these are things that upset, didn't help you to move back into civilian life. That's a bad part. That's why you got itchy feet, because you didn't want to sort of be with people. And even from a point of female company. We had no female company during that period there when you were in the Middle East and in New Guinea. This is imperial. This is not for broadcast here, but...
We were talking about some of the ways in which your experience made it difficult for you to come back and
be
work your way into the civilian life again. We can talk about that a bit later on if you like. Can you tell us what was involved in your decision to... join up in the first place?
Well, as soon as I saw it in the paper that Australia had declared war, I just sort of decided to myself, well, I've got to be in this. And I bought a paper this day, and I can remember quite well sitting on this open stand at the recreation ground in Bunbury where we used to play our football, and sitting up there and thinking, oh, God, you know, it's on. Well, I've got to be in it like everyone else did.
What were some of the headlines that you can recall.
Oh, just probably war declared, I can't say for sure, John. And
did you recall the occasion when Menzies announced it on the radio, for instance?
No. Well, I don't think we had a radio in the house, so that was out. In fact, we didn't have a radio, because I remember now, just after that, that the landlady bought a radio, as a matter of fact. I remember the instance when the other young chap who was below me in the office, he was a pretty shrewd head, and the landlord I was with said, Jim, when you're going on your way home, would you call into Slater and South, was the name of the firm, they're not electrical now, and said, asked him to come down and see me about buying a radio. And I mentioned to this young office boy, he was about the same age as myself, and I said, when you're up down delivering letters around town, you know, he said, yeah, he said, what do you reckon we'll get for it? I said, not being as sharp as what it is, what do you mean? He said, oh, we should get about 30 bob for this. I said, oh, if it suits you, so we got 15 bob each out of it for putting them onto a sale. So I remember that, and that was after war had been declared. Anyway, but I enlisted in March of 1940 with a big number of chaps from Bunbury.
Why did you feel as though you had to be in it?
Australia was a war, and that was it, and it was Australia, and it was going to be part of it. Not for making a big fellow, so we're brave or anything, it was just that Australia was at war, and I suppose I felt it was your responsibility, and that was it. And I think all the chaps I was spoken to, well, the ones I was spoken to, have said similar things to me.
Did you talk about the decision with your mates at all?
No. Just went along on my own, as a matter of fact, and enlisted.
What were your thoughts of England at the time?
No, I just thought that Australia was at war, and that was it. Australia was at war, and we were Australians, and I was going to be in it with them.
What happened then? You went to join up?
Well, I enlisted in March of 1940. A bit strange, actually. So happened because all the chaps I'd enlisted with, I think it was in June, they all got called up. And I didn't get a call up. And we, in Bunbury, we didn't have a recruitment office. They used to come down from Perth about once a month. So when they came down the next month, I went along and I said, hey, listen, I enlisted with all these folks and I got called up. And the chap, he was a returned AIF chap from the First World War, said, and what he said would have been perfectly right and true, he said, don't worry, laddie, it's not going to finish next week. Well, he said, there'll be plenty of time for you.
You're talking about June 1940.
Yeah.
It was during sort of May and, you know, July that Dunkirk had fallen, France was falling.
Probably that was what instilled it in so many, because I do remember now that you mentioned that the 6th Division, who enlisted first of all, I don't think people realised when these chaps went that it was such a big deal for Australia. I don't really think that people did think of it such a big... But that's probably what it was you were saying. That's when this happened. That's probably what shook us up a bit more, you know, most likely. But unfortunately, in my case... Well, I say fortunately, that's fate, how it works out.
What was involved with you joining up? Did you have to sign anything at all?
Yeah. I forget, but I can tell you one thing. A chap who was there, and when we must have had a medical of some sort straight away, did we? And this chap only had one eye. And the chap said, well, you can't enlist. He said, why? He said, you've only got one eye. He said, you don't want men, you want bloody potatoes down. And that's an expression that stuck with me right through the years, because he didn't get in naturally. But I went down when they came back into the town the following month, and that's the expression he said. He said, you know, don't worry, laddie, plenty of time, and won't finish next week. And I was sort of stuck in limbo for a while, and one day the accountant said to me, Jim, I think you're going to get your call up next week. I thought, oh, that's good, you know, being young, a bit naive. I never thought, how the hell does he know that I'm going to get called up? My boss was a manpower officer, and without saying to me, they just they'd made sure I was left aside. Must have been too lazy to replace me, because I was only a cashier. So I didn't go in until September, which meant I missed all the chaps I'd enlisted with. And later on I can tell you how I came to be back with them, because I got back with them later on. Because by coincidence, one thing I do remember well, the day that I did join up, because I wasn't 21, you were supposed to be, plenty of blokes when I was 20. I rang my father in Perth and said, "You have enlisted?" He said, "That's funny." He said, "Your brother enlisted in Fremantle today." That's my older brother. And that's how I finished up in the 2nd 16th Battalion, because elder brothers or fathers could claim younger brothers or sons into the unit with them. I don't think it is a good idea in hindsight, but in my case, it...
Why not?
Well, I can tell you of instances, as a matter of fact, where an elder brother wasn't happy about the amount of patrol work his younger brother was getting, and he spoke to the loot about it. And on another occasion, one of these chaps is alive, when his brother got killed, they were both in New Guinea, when his brother got killed, they sent him back. They didn't want two from the family, you know, to do it. I think you can, although when I was wounded, and it was pretty bad, I know this is something we'll talk about again later, and because things were so bad at the time, they put a blanket over me, completely even over my head, because I think they didn't want me to see what was going to happen, because we were no more than 50 yards from the Japs at the time. And while I was lying there, worrying about the fact there was a blanket over me, I heard my elder brother's voice say, "I believe you've got the young bloke here." And somebody said, "Yeah, he's under the blanket." You imagine what he felt or thought. So he pulled the blanket back. He said, "Oh, you're all right." I said, "Well, fair enough, you know, reasonable." But he had to be on his way, you know. Imagine if I hadn't been all right, how it probably would have affected him. And I think this is where it's bad. I think they do it from the point of view that they can look after the younger one. But after all, if he's old enough to enlist and can't look after himself, and you can't have someone stopping to say, "Well, I know there's that song about get up in my horse's room for two," and that sort of thing, but that's all right sometimes in theory. Anyway.
Did your father have any words to say to you about joining up at all?
Prior to that? No, not at all. No, I just rang him and he said, "Oh, you know, good on you." And he said, "Your brother enlisted today, purely by coincidence."
What about your mother? What did she feel about all this?
Well, I wasn't living at home, you see. I was living in Bunbury all the time. And I went straight from Bunbury into the services. I wasn't at home to discuss it with them.
Tell us about the training and what that involved.
Well, I didn't get called up until September. As I say, the accountant told me it's a bit rough, but... I spent, and I don't know whether even at that stage they had ideas that the Japs were coming in, because a lot of the other chaps, including the chaps I enlisted with, only had perhaps 4 months of training here. At our time, we had 9 months in Western Australia before we went away. I think 3 months down at Naval Base, in the camp, there used to be an army camp there, and the rest of the time up at Northam, six months at Northam.
Near Garden Island?
No, on the mainland at Naval Base. Woodman's Point, you know where Woodman's Point is now, and the Austell shipping, all this on the other side of the road up on the hill. That was quite a big
quite close to the harbour in Fremantle.
Well, that's where it was there. Of course, there was no harbour like where the Woodman's like it is now, but that's where there was quite a big army camp there. And then we had 6 months up in Northern before we went overseas.
What did the training involve?
Oh, all sorts of lots, like the things that I saw the other day. The bayonet work, you know, learning with the dummies hanging up from there. Route marches, a lot of what always suited me. I loved the route march because I was always a walker, and still am a person who enjoys walking a lot. Patrol work and compass work, night stunts and on the rifle range. That was at Northam, not at Naval Base. There was a rifle range at Northam. Hand grenade, had to handle a hand grenade and toss them and various.
How did you feel at the time doing all this training, although there was not a hell of a lot of action really?
No, but it was just something I think that you felt that with training, there's no doubt about it, that with training it instills, or it automatically instills into you what you are going to do, because, for instance, I can remember our first day against the Japs when we were told to charge, and I used to think even in hindsight, sometimes you'd see the chaps in the First World War get out the trenches when they were told they were going to get mowed down, but the first day that we struck the Japs in New Guinea, we were opened up on because we were looking for it, and had to cross some open country, and we were opened up and went to ground. And we only went to ground for a matter of seconds, because had you gone to ground for longer, you would have sort of been transfixed to the ground, but the officer did the right thing. We no sooner to the ground, he said, charge, and everyone charged. And that, in hindsight, didn't think about it at the time, he just did it. In hindsight, that was because that's what you were trained to do. And that's what training, and I suppose the more training you had before you went to action, the more it was instilled in you, did it automatically. I can remember that one very well, as a matter of fact. And it's not something that would have happened a lot, particularly up in the islands, where you've been called out to charge. But when he said, there was no hesitation. No one hesitated at all. But I do admire him that we hit the ground and within seconds we're up again.
Did you sort of feel prepared by the time you were to leave?
Oh, well, we'd had so much training, yeah. We were in good nick. And we'd had, you know, you'd had the training to dismantle and assemble machine guns and look after your equipment, and we knew that we were in good condition.
And what was the equipment that you were supplied?
Only a rifle to carry, a rifle and your webbing equipment, that sort of thing.
Did you feel as though, you know, this was adequate?
Yeah, for the job you were going to do, yeah, because you knew that within the battalion you have all the other, in headquarter company, you have your mortar platoon, your machine gun platoon, and your transport platoon, and you knew that others had specialised jobs within the battalion, but you were just a rifleman, and that was your job was to learn to use a light machine gun and a rifle and grenade. So, and 9 months of training, and that was a lot of training. So you felt well prepared to go over there.
Some people I've interviewed and read about also, the equipment was fairly substandard, I understand.
Oh, but in the Middle East it was good equipment when you had good webbing equipment.
Can you tell us then, you know, what your thoughts were about leaving? Did you know, for instance, where you were going to be sent?
Oh, you knew, I won't say the only place, because I think about that time they also sent them to Singapore, before the Japs had come into the war, of course. And from this state, there was the 2nd 4th Machine Gun Battalion that went to Singapore. As a matter of fact, to be quite honest, when I was in Northern Camp, this is just purely by coincidence, when I was in Northern Camp on one occasion, I had a couple of stripes I'd got early before I went away. And an officer came to me one day and said, so-and-so, Jim, he said, would you be interested in going to another unit? I said, well, what's it about? Because it's always an older age, don't volunteer. And he said, well, I can't tell you much about it, so I'll hush-hush. And being a young 20-year-old, all right, if you didn't want to tell me, I'm not interested. You know, you're not a big shot, but if I couldn't be told, well, I wouldn't. And as it turned out, they were the chaps who went to Timor. It was the second independent company who went to Timor. I'm glad in a way I didn't go there, because I had a wider experience by going to the Middle East, and although I think they finished up in New Guinea too, but still, you had a different experience.
Well, these are the double diamonds.
Yeah.
Tell us what you know about them.
Not a great amount, only what I've heard, and apparently in Timor they did a marvellous job, and it's something that from what I'd heard and from what you expect and experience yourself, that the Australian government treated the Timorese shabbily, what was it in, was it about 75 or somewhere, when Indonesia took them over, and we did nothing about, Australia did nothing about it all. And I've often thought then, when you think of what the East Timorese did for Australians in Timor, God knows how many lives they must have saved, and yet when it came to, I'm not saying it from a point of going to war with them, but I don't think that Australia ever did much to discourage the Indonesians from taking over Timor. And I suppose it's a bit typical of governments. When it suits, they do what suits them, doesn't it? But that's something that always stuck in my craw with the, and I knew quite a few of the chaps who were in the company too, in school.
Did you know what state the war was at the time of your departure?
Oh, no, well, it was still pretty early, you know, it was still pretty early. I mean, I know things, of course, we know things hadn't been good in Europe, but in the desert, you know, it was a to-and-fro job there, you know. Firstly, it was when the Italians were there, it wasn't much trouble, because I don't think they really were that keen on the war. In fact, one of the things that was stuck in my mind was, when we landed at Port Tewfik and went from there by train up to El Cantara, which is on the canal, and I can remember thinking, how can so many prisoners of war have ever been taken. They're all Italians. I think they were quite happy to be out of it. I don't think they ever really had their heart and soul in. And of course, when the Australians were fighting Italians, they had a lot of success. But of course, when it came up against the Germans, it was a different story altogether.
So when was it that you were to arrive in the Middle East?
In May, late in May 1941. Yeah.